stretch your quads and strap on your trainers. This week on The Stack, we burn off our festive paunches with an invigorating jog through the pages of a new magazine looking at how the rest of us go running. Plus, how a legacy psychology title gets inside our heads. And Jeremy Leslie surveys the state of print going into the new year. That's all ahead on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, half an hour of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. In recent years, running has evolved from an activity partaken in, perhaps begrudgingly, strictly to keep fit, to a full-blown lifestyle. A welcome side effect of this expansion has been a proliferation of magazines and websites that eschew the top 10 product lists and diet recommendations of traditional titles, and instead shed light on how running is experienced by people other than the professionals. One such publication is Run for Your Life. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to its editor, Luke Leafield.
Luke, a pleasure to welcome here at Monocle 24. Thanks so much for coming. I'm looking at the first issue of your new magazine, Run for Your Life. First of all, we're talking here that, you know, of course you're a copywriter, but you're also a musician. How come did you enter in the world of magazines?
Well, I've been into running for a few years, maybe like 7 or 8 years, and I got more serious the last few years. And the guy on the cover, there's an older guy on the cover, he's a guy called Ken, he's 74. And I met him because he's the running partner of my brother, who I do a few marathons with. So my brother said, I've started running with this guy who goes into my pub. You know, he's an older guy, he's called Ken. And I was like, all right, sounds fine. He didn't say much more about him. Then I met him at this marathon, and I was like, wow, he's like an old guy. And Ken's run well over 100 marathons, like 120, 100. I don't even know if he knows. The more I was talking to him, because we've met and done a few races now, I was like, this guy's so interesting, and no one's ever going to know anything about him, right? Because he's a secondhand car salesman in the Midlands, in like a tiny place, and people just aren't going to know his story. And I found him so interesting. I just wanted to interview him. So really, it was a selfish thing. I wanted to interview Ken. And then when I'd done it, I was like, well, this is really great, but I don't just want to put it online because there's a lot of stuff on the internet, right? So I just feel like you engage with interviews or content differently online to offline. So I wanted to do something printed, which meant I had to interview some more people because probably just a magazine with an interview of one person wouldn't be all that great. I'm into independent magazines. You know, I read a lot of them. So it was the kind of logical choice for what to do.
And I have to say, I mean, even though, of course, it's about running, people that run, but even for a non-sports person, I think somebody that is not actually, who doesn't run actually, might be interested to read that. Was that in your mind? Because it doesn't look like a generic sports magazine.
Yeah, that's exactly what we wanted to do. So I guess making a running magazine and running as much as I do, people think I'm like really evangelical about running. Mm. I think running can be good for people. You know, I don't really mind whether people choose to do it or not, but I wanted to make something that was accessible to people that consider running something that they could never do. So I'm someone who never really did well at sports at school. I feel like being cool and being good at sports are like the same thing, and I was neither of those things. So when I came to start running, I felt like it was totally alien to me. Do you know what I mean? Like I couldn't see myself as a runner. And now I definitely am a runner. So I wanted to make something that wouldn't put this barrier between the people reading it so that they could see themselves in the people in the magazine. And that's also the way that we chose the people that we interviewed. So it's people young and old. They're not all great runners. Like if I wanted to make a magazine, just go and speak to great runners, I could have done that because I know some really, really good runners. And some of the people in there are like great. But I just wanted to speak to people where running is a part of their life. So that means it's something you're doing fairly regularly and it means something to you. Yeah, and I wanted to make something that would encourage other people to try running.
And tell us about the process of making that magazine. Did you start as a Kickstarter? I've seen that you've got orders from all around the world. That's amazing.
Yeah,
I was checking on your website. But tell us, how did you achieve that level?
So I interviewed people in the spring of 2016 when I was living in Sweden. I finished all the interviews then, but obviously, like, it's not just interviews, right? It's design and photography. And I moved back to England that summer, and that's when we did the photography. So it took quite a long time to happen. I think, like, anyone that's made a magazine before or, you know, something of this scale, like, it's just a huge undertaking, and it's quite hard work if you want to do a good job. So once we had everything together, yeah, we did a Kickstarter. So like, I'd done it before, and I knew it could work, and because I don't know that many people that like running in my circle, but I thought if we can put this on Kickstarter, there's going to be people that love running or magazines all around the world who could get into it. The Kickstarter was successful. It's quite a manual process. Like, we don't have a distributor, so we've been emailing people all around the world, like running shops and magazine shops, about stocking it. And now it's kind of stocked in quite a few places. So it's been really fun.
Are you thinking already about issue two? I mean, or what's your plans for the future of the magazine?
That's a great question. So I made it with two of my really good friends, and we like making things together. So we'll definitely do something else. Right now, we're not sure if we want to make another magazine about running, or whether we want to take, because it is a magazine about running, but really it's about people. We're kind of deciding whether we want to make, yeah, another magazine about running, or maybe we want to focus on another like passion or hobby that people have, which will obviously take it in a totally different direction. I think that...
But you can still keep the name, Run For Your Life. Who knows?
Well, we might do that, or we might do like, you know, something else for your life. Because this magazine, I really like it. I think it's great, but I don't think it's a magazine you read cover to cover, because the 11 interviews take kind of the same format. So it's something you dip in and out of. And I'm like, that's fine for one magazine, but I don't quite know if it's the right concept for a series. It's a lot of work as well, like for all of us. So you really want to be sure that it's something you want to invest a lot of time in, because it takes a lot of time to do it right, I think.
What about the design? I quite like the design. You know, it's very clean, but it also has an amazing color palette as well. So what's the color of the cover again?
It is, what would you call that? It's sort of like a, I don't know, turquoisey, marine-y.
I kind of light turquoise, I would say, no?
Yeah, something like that. We almost went with pink. I really like pink, but everyone else decided blue was the best one, so...
Yeah, I think it matches.
That's pretty kind.
So how big is the team? You mentioned you were working with your friends, so...
It's just three of us. Mm. So I edited everything and sort of did some creative direction. I guess we're all doing that, really, helping to guide there. Where we were going. Tom Price did all the photography. He's an amazing photographer. And all the photography in here is like film photography. So it's a bit experimental, which was really fun when we came to put the magazine together. Because, you know, if you've got like digital photography, you've got like hundreds and hundreds of images to choose from. And we have very few images to choose from. When we came to do the design, it was quite freeing, because it's like, well, they're the photos you've got. Like, that's it. And some of them aren't exactly probably what Tom would want them to be at times. But there are no photos of anyone in their running gear, which was also kind of deliberate. It is a running magazine, but it's also kind of like not, like it's about people. And we wanted to make it really accessible. And I find like when you look at, you know, you see like big Nike billboards and everyone's like really sexy and in their Lycra and they just like look amazing. They're like running. I just find that really boring. And I think like if you're someone who doesn't run, you look at that and you think that's not me. So we wanted to show like people in their normal environment. So it's like, you know, this is Ken sitting in his office, but he's also a runner, right? And it's like, this is Steve, like cooking in a kitchen, but he's also a runner.
If someone is interested, do you have a website where people can look out or maybe even order a copy?
We do. And the website is gotlegs.club. Yeah, we've got a little store on there.
Listen, Luke, it's a pleasure to meet you and well done for Run For Your Life. I'm hoping there will be an issue too, because I thought it was quite an interesting magazine.
We'll do our best to get another one out.
Yeah.
And thanks very much for having me.
Luke Leafield there, speaking to Fernando, and issue one of Run For Your Life is out now. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Time to catch up with a dear friend of the programme. Jeremy Leslie is a print impresario. I'm saying it. Who runs ModMag. He's laughing. I don't know why. A brand encompassing a magazine shop, website and design studio as well, of course, as an annual magazine conference. And Jeremy joins me in the studio.
Lovely to be here.
2018 has kicked off, but we're in the early knockings. And it's nice to sort of do a bit of a temperature take, Jeremy. It wasn't too long ago that we last spoke. Where are we at? Big picture, magazines-wise. We spoke at Steve Watson Stack Awards very recently, and there were so many young startups. That felt tremendously positive in terms of independent publishing. What's the watchwords for 2018? Is it about spreading the same message, but yet wider?
Exactly that. I think the challenge we have now is that everyone here at Stack, people at Mag Culture, we're all deeply involved in and observant of what's going on. And the big issue, really, the mission now must be to spread the word. Mm. One of the things I did over the Christmas break was go to the Design Museum, where they've got their annual Designs of the Year awards on. Exhibition on, and they have as I'm sure you and the listeners are aware, but it's a huge panoply of different creative forms of design, including graphics, and amongst the graphics there were two magazines, which was really great to see. They quite often do feature magazines, but there was New York Times Magazine favourite of ours, and Real Review, another favourite. And it was great to see them in the context of all sorts of architecture and digital projects and fashion projects, etc. And it's, I think that's the big sort of hump we've got to get over now, is just try and get all this fantastic magazine work in front of people that maybe are still thinking that magazines have disappeared over the hill.
And where does that, I mean, it's a responsibility I guess we all share, and those who are invested in it, literally or metaphorically, are going to do their damnedest. Is it about improving, and we often talk here at Monocle about distribution practices, point of sale, is it about that side of things? Is it about the story? How does that message get spread most effectively in your experience?
Well, I mean, the one thing we've tried to do since we opened the shop is exactly that, and it's the same with you guys and Kiosk Cafe, is improve the experience and let people find out for themselves. So, and we still get people stumbling into the shop and looking around and scratching their heads, and then you have a conversation with them and they get it, you know.
What is this strange place? What are these things?
Magazines? and it's just, it's, I don't know, it's shouting loud and clear as much as possible. There, you know, there's always this sense of other people from other newspapers, magazines, sort of sniffing around, trying to get their sense of the story. And I think it can only build. It's been building now for quite some time. And that, for me, is the thing for 2018. Is there's no question there's still lots of fantastic magazines being made, lots of exciting things. We can look at some in a minute. But it's arguing the case more strongly. It's lovely to go to the Design Museum and see such projects there. I think it'd be even lovelier if they would actually spend some time and looking, you know, do an exhibition about this area of activity, because they seem to continually overlook it.
Indeed.
I think there's a project planned at one of the other big institutes in London this year, which I think will help open it up to a wider public, but we'll hear more about that in some near the time.
Indeed. So sort of consolidation and maintaining momentum, I suppose, really.
Well, the momentum is there. I mean, I can't see it not being maintained. It just, there's still amongst people doing it. I mean, whether it's at ModMag or the Stack Awards, you get the absolute passion is explicit in the air as people talk and meet and share projects.
Well, maybe we'll talk about this, because let's dive into some of the mags you've got, and maybe just some of the other good stories from 2017 and into 2018. One thing that I did like, particularly about the Stack Awards, was this sense of intergenerational. There was some really exciting and innovative student magazines. There were some, I mean, I'm going to say they're almost like kids starting magazines. And then there were some old favourites. And people have been doing these things, but still at the cutting edge and still innovating after decades sometimes producing magazines. That reassured me a great deal. It's not about, you know, a dying art practiced by a few. And yet it's not just about young tyros cutting their, trying their hand. It's everybody, every age range, different backgrounds, experience. And that's key
to it all. It bodes well, but it's also a key part of the story, I think, because I think some people do make that mistake and assume, if another person says to me, oh, you know, so these magazines, so it's a bit like the revival of vinyl. Sigh, you know. No, it's not. It's a much more passionate thing than that. It's people that believe print is stronger than other medium they might choose. And it is all ages. That's key.
Yeah, it's very encouraging. Well, let's have a look at what some of the things you've got, and we can meander off at a tangent as well. Maybe just start where you like, Jeremy.
Well, I shall do. I think if we're talking about selecting print as a medium, I think a little free magazine that recently caught our eye at Mag Culture called Homesick. It promises a look at archive materials that are not available online. I think there is an assumption that everything's online now. You just have to find the right search terms and you find it. Whereas this magazine is digging deeper and discovering things from popular culture that aren't available online and distributing in this first issue as a free magazine. But I think there's a future for it in a broader sense. It covers everything from fashion. It covers magazines itself. There's a curator collecting magazines based in Margate. There's a thing about posters and materials to do with the 80s band, the Young Marble Giants, favourite of mine, which is how I first caught my eye. It's a lovely little project, and that does what, you know, I was talking to someone earlier today about what do you want from a magazine, and I think you want to be surprised, and this surprises you. You're not going to find this material elsewhere.
You can't beat the tactile nature of a printed image and the quietness of holding it and considering it. A full page quote from Michelle Meyer-Masterson, who's one of these archivists, and you know, truer words not spoken on this show in a while. Anyway,
absolutely.
where should we go next, Jeremy? There's loads to fill in.
We're still, of course, I mean, we can't deny there are still magazines closing, and I think, you know, the women's press has suffered a lot recently. Teen Vogue was closing, seemed extraordinary, so kind of shift from what seemed to be a successful project. Equally, Print Magazine, the big graphic design kind of huge influential magazine in the States is closing. So I bought along a couple of magazines that contrast with those two. In the Women's Market, Mush Pit, of course, which has been much covered here before. Yeah. But the new issue is astoundingly good, both in that it maintains its millennial angst and sense of humour. But it's been the girls, Charlotte and Bertie, have been joined by Richard Turley, late of Bloomberg Businessweek, and the two of them together have made this most extraordinary editorial product, which is truly exciting and bodes well not just for that project but just for the idea of women's magazines per se, which is a huge growth area despite the mainstream suffering so much.
I was going to say, you talk about a couple of those high profile mainstream closures, and again, I'm loath to try and draw connections where there are none, but what are the stories where this happens? Is it about management who become disconnected from what the product's supposed to be and don't understand it anymore? Is it about mismanagement of funds, of contributors? Where we see titles that seem to be in the right place at the right time closing, I mean, are there strands that run through as to why they can't make a go of it?
I think there are clearly major business model problems across the field. And people tend to focus on that being a problem for magazines. And I don't think it's really a problem for magazines so much as a problem for content per se.
Yeah.
And we have to get over this idea that people aren't prepared to pay for stuff. Starting from a much smaller kind of startup proposition, something like Mush Pit, and there's a whole range of women's magazines, and going back to the age thing, women's magazines being made by young women for young women, importantly, that are circumnavigating. You know, they don't need to have a huge office in the World Trade Center. They don't need to have all these overheads, and they're starting afresh again. And who knows where they might be in 10 years' time.
That suggests that maybe there is almost a sort of an optimum size, even for a startup to then get to. And you can almost become too big. And if you're just a cog in a big, you know, machine or a massive publishing house that's, you know, pumping out 50, 60 or more titles a month, it can be harder to not maintain your editorial direction, but to fit into that infrastructure. I guess that's a different kind of problem.
Yes, you also become far less nimble and far less adept at shifting where you need to shift.
Yeah. We talk a lot about the dexterity of the smaller players, and it's certainly true in independent publishing.
And then on the design side, I mentioned print magazine closing. A particular favourite of mine is Adventures in Typography. It's from the Spin Studio and Unit Editions, a London publisher. And their second edition is just out. And it's another fantastic exposition on creative typography. It's nothing better than the sight of some great graphic designers throwing open their working processes and having fun with it. This one's primarily orientated by numbers. And the first one was just shape making and letter form making. This is a little more content to it, and it's having a bit more fun with it. And it's recommended for anybody interested in design. It's just a lovely, beautifully produced item, but it's the sort of thing that works in print and struggles online.
Yeah, no, that's a lovely thing, a joy. Spin number two. So get your copy. Where should we go next? We're continuing this.
It's a fast-paced
rattle through. Yeah.
Well, one of the magazines I've been anxiously waiting and has finally turned up is the fifth issue of MacGuffin. And going back to the attention it received last year, not least at the Stack Awards again. But
A double winner.
And if you're going to win two awards, what better than Art Director of the Year and Editor of the Year? That's a pretty complete kind of...
You've got some good people involved, right? That's happening.
I hope by now most people listening already know MacGuffin and know what to expect. In case not, it's a biannual magazine, and each one takes one thing or item of furniture or general kind of daily purpose item, and examines it in great detail. It's a research-based project. So this one's all about, I mean, they've done the window, the bed, rope. This one's about the cabinet. And it's partly a history, partly a kind of a take. We visit IKEA and discover about the little kind of reflection on the Billy bookcase and various things like this.
Never ceases to amaze me with MacGuffin. It's the sort of the breadth of the coverage of the item.
Mm-hmm.
And it's authoritative and serious and lighthearted and funny and literal, and yet it surprises you. You kind of think it can't surprise when its ambit is relatively limited, but in fact you sense that they could have made this a thousand pages. They're so clever, and the editorial process.
To me it's a design magazine for non-designers. I mean, designers can absolutely appreciate not only the design of the magazine itself but the written content in it. It gives a context for design. It's fantastic.
No, it's too good, and they keep doing it. What's that? That's fifth.
That's
so they're still
flying. still going. They're still going. Still flying high.
Good to see. So, Jeremy, plenty of standout titles. As you said, I'm buoyed just by leafing through some of these, particularly New MacGuffin, which is lovely to see. That's the first time I've seen it. 2018. What else is on the agenda for you? All sorts. Always. You're a busy man.
There's lots of. We're already planning Mod Mag for this November. We've got another couple of events that we'll be announcing, which I can't announce now because they're not firmed up. But there's something we
have. That's exciting. That's really exciting. That's good. That's good.
And the other thing we're still very excited about is a series of podcasts we published at the end of last year, interviews with leading magazine editors about an individual feature in their magazine, and then you hear the feature read. So that included many friends of us and Stack and Mag Culture in terms of Jake Silverman from New York Times Magazine, Christoph from Zeit, Victory Journals there. There's a really nice set of... And we're very excited about the possibility of going forward with podcasts, and so we expect more of that. The website's very busy, and that continues to carry reviews, but sometimes you don't get the full passion in a written interview, and actually hearing people, meeting people, and hearing them talk about their magazines is something we're going to be doing a lot more of in the next year.
Quaderat demonstrandum, as we're doing right now.
Where did I get that idea from?
Excellent stuff. Jeremy, great to see you, as always. All the best for 2018.
Thank you.
We'll be seeing and hearing more from you, I'm sure, in the weeks and months ahead.
I hope so. Pleasure to be here, and Happy New Year.
You're with The Stack on Monocle 24. Now, the language of psychology is central to the way we think and talk about ourselves and the world around us. But up until about the middle of the last century, psychology was largely confined to the ivory towers of academia. In 1967, Psychology Today magazine was launched with the aim of making the subject more accessible. Over half a century later, it's still a presence on newsstands across the United States and Canada. Illustrating frequently abstract psychological concepts like love, depression, and desire in print is no mean feat. To find out more about how the magazine does it, Monocle's Fernando Pacheco spoke to photo director Claudia Stefesius.
Claudia, what a pleasure to welcome here at Monocle 24. We're here to talk about Psychology Today. You work there as the photo director and also help with the shoots. Tell us a bit more about the magazine. I believe it's celebrating 50 years, correct?
Yes, this year is our 50th anniversary, and it's really great to see how far the magazine has come. I'm very excited to be part of it.
And tell us about the mission of the magazine. I mean, we're talking, and a bit more details. Does it come every month, for example?
Well, PG is a bi-monthly lifestyle magazine. It's devoted to everyone's favorite subject, which is ourselves. So the stories address why we behave the way we do and how we engage with the world around us. Our mission is to assist readers with making healthy lifestyle choices and by embracing positive behavioral changes. And it's published by Sussex Publishers and owned by Joe Coleman, who is British. And our reader is primarily a female, and I might as well say the circulation is 260,000, so now you have it all.
And it is quite a high circulation for a magazine of this type. Let's talk a bit more about the reader. Is it someone that is interested in psychology, or you have the occasional buyer who is looking at newsstands? How do you divide? Because I believe a lot of therapists would read your magazine as well.
The interesting thing is that we have over 130,000 therapists that receive Psychology Today. And what's nice is a PT has a dual audience. So if you're interested in changing your life or learn more about a certain subject, you can pick it up at a newsstand, a bookstore or Hudson News or Whole Foods actually sells it too.
How do you translate? Because, psychology, we talk about love, about your inner mental health as well. How do you translate that with pictures and the whole design of the magazine overall as well?
That's a very interesting process. The art department is essentially the creative director at Levine and myself. So we also do our own casting. So it's all rolled into one. And
it includes animals as well, I guess.
Yeah, the casting has included animals, chimps and goats and rabbits and down to snails. Casting for a model is not just looking for a pretty face. A lot of times the models are also actresses, and they have the difficult task to emote a certain human emotion, like jealousy, or, for example, we've done a cover story on The Sixth Sense, which sold very well. And for that, we needed a model that could emote a certain look in her eye, and she had a white face and she looked very futuristic and surreal. And that was our way of showing, the sixth sense. So, but to answer your question in more detail, so we get a rough draft from the editors. So we read, extract the essence of the story, and then we think about a main idea that will best illustrate what the story is about. The next step is to develop that main idea that becomes the jumping off point for the visuals to take shape. So that sounds really abstract, and it is abstract. But the bottom line is you have to create a visual that the reader that is visually aesthetic and beautiful, but also the concept tells a story about jealousy. So for that, for example, we had a model. She had like green makeup. Her face was all, you know, painted green makeup. And at one point at the shoot, she decided to scream and she had her eyes closed. And, you know, she just like let her emotion out of just thought of something, you know, that was connected to jealousy. And it was the perfect cover. And we ran it as a cover.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Also, I would like to ask more about your career previously. Did you ever had any experience in the psychology world or more the publishing world? What was your background before psychology today?
It's interesting. I was always interested in psychology. My background is actually in literature. I have a master's in American Lit, but one of my favorite authors was Henry James, and there's a lot of psychology and things like that going on. And, you know, I thought about studying psychology, and somehow I got into publishing. I was a writer and foreign correspondent. And I was always interested in psychology, photography, and somehow it found me. I don't really have a better way of explaining it.
And I love comparing how countries deal with certain situations, especially in the psychology world. I think, you know, now you live in a country which is, am I correct to say they're very open when it comes to express their feelings about mental issues? Because, for example, a country like England is a bit different, and you're also from Germany. How would you differentiate those countries and how those topics are covered as well?
I like to think of Woody Allen as like a, as sort of like a, to describe a sense of, you know, Americans were always very open about, oh, I have a therapist's appointment. There wasn't a stigma, especially now, there's no stigma to it. Everybody has a therapist. I would say growing up in Germany, it definitely, if somebody said, oh, I'm seeing a shrink, people would say, well, what's wrong with you, you know? So that is definitely, United States definitely is a forerunner and opened the doors for, you know, people to be more comfortable with admitting that I have a problem and this is what I'm doing about it. I think psychology today is really unique in that way where it is bridges the gap between, it's a health magazine, it's a lifestyle magazine, but it has a very serious, everything that we write about is based on the latest research. And I think in that it's very unique.
And Claudia, finally, I would like to ask a question I ask all the guests. You know, we all love magazines. I was wondering, besides, of course, Psychology Today, which other magazines or newspapers do you enjoy reading?
The New Yorker has always been my favorite. I also started reading a weekend edition of the Financial Times, the New York Times, of course. I also love, from home, Die Zeit magazine and Süddeutsche magazine very much. So that's more of a digital read, however. I prefer print. It's just cozier way of reading something, especially when it's a long story and looking at art. And I love Monocle, Vanity Fair, and New York Magazine. That sort of is what I enjoy.
The good classics.
Yeah, Gather. I think, you know, the other day I was at a bookstore and I picked that up and it was really, the art was really, you know, well done. And so I think that could be another new favorite of mine.
It's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming.
Sure. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Claudia Stefesius from Psychology Today, talking to Fernando. And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to Fernando and Henry Rhys Sheridan and our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. If you have any comments or queries, do drop a note to Fernando. He'll find him at fp@monocle.com. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.